First off, I would like to thank all of our speakers this weekend. They've been awesome. And, you know, our next speaker, you know, I had the privilege of hearing him about 7 years ago at the Arizona Regional Convention of Narcotics Anonymous. It was the first convention my wife had attended. And, you know, he made a real big impact on this little area. Because during his share, he was talking about addicts in different places. And he happened to mention little old Yuma, Arizona. And at that particular moment in time, Yuma was struggling as an area just to find its identity within this fellowship. And so for him to put us on the map kind of was big. And you know, we have never forgotten that. Never. And he rides around with us when we go on convention rides. You know, Brenda talked about it last night about CDs and what a blessing they are sometimes, you know. And we carry Chuck around not only in our hearts but in our cars. And you know, and ever since that convention, you know, the Chuck H. Fan Club was born. You know, it is my extreme honor and privilege to introduce my friend Chuck H.
Okay, addict named Chuck. Can y'all hear me? She told me which mic was which, but I've already forgotten because I'm, you know, petrified. If I'd have known I was going to get in that much trouble by mentioning Yuma, I'd have just said Phoenix. Yeah. But I'm an addict named Chuck. Everybody can hear me? Because if you can't hear me, raise your hand up. Can you hear me? Because I'm kind of tall. Okay. You know, being the Sunday morning speaker is a form of slow death because you spend the entire weekend listening to people hit it out of the park, and God's just been turning up the heat ever since I got here on Thursday. And this morning about 3 o'clock, the committee in my head woke me up and God, come on, buddy, you got to get up. It's 6 o'clock Florida time. You know, let's do this. And I'm over there, you know, because I'm not only an addict, but I have Tourette's. I've lived with Tourette's my entire life, and my Tourette's is kicking in. I'm over there rocking back and forth in my chair going, if these people see me, they're going to think I'm crazy. Matter of fact, Tony saw me last night, and my tics were starting to set in, and I was starting to rock. And he came over and asked me if I was okay, and I said, yeah, I'm fine. It's just the Tourette's coming out in me, you know, so I'll be fine because I know that God's got this. And I have faith in two things whenever I get up to share. And that's the grace and mercy of a loving God and the power of the unconditional love of the people in Narcotics Anonymous. Without those two things, there's no way I would even attempt to do this, because people with Tourette's don't usually make good public speakers. You know, I mean, we speak in public, but we're not good public speakers. I wanna take another moment of silence so that my heart will, you know, idle down a little bit, and so that we can all kind of get in tune with the spirit that is in this room right now, that we can all connect with our higher power, my higher power, your higher power, and we can all come together in one spirit, because what we're doing here this morning is very, very serious. And we'll have that moment of silence now. Now, I want you to keep your eyes closed. I want you to keep your eyes closed, and I want you to go with me on a journey. This morning, I woke up, and I looked out over the Arizona desert, and I watched the sun come up. And I thought about what a long journey it's been from that moment all the way back to the moment when I was lying on a cold bathroom floor in my own blood, my own puke, telling God to either kill me or help me, because I couldn't live like that five more minutes. And to wake up and look out over that desert and see the sun come up. And I want you to go back to that last moment, because there's 2 days and an addict will remember. That's the last day using and the first day clean. I want you to go back to that moment when you'd had enough, when you cried out, please help me. I can't live like this anymore. Now I want you to open your eyes. I want you to look around you at God's response.
You see? Yeah.
Welcome to the miracle of Narcotics Anonymous. You see? Welcome to the answered prayer of the suffering addict. I always take what I do here very seriously when I share, because the words that we share in these meetings and that get recorded on these tapes are the words of life to the addict who's still out there suffering. Words of life, because when I got clean in NA, and I got my NA recovery off of speaker CDs. Well, back then it was cassette tapes. I'm serious. It was cassette tapes. As a matter of fact, I got about 2,000 cassette tapes at home that I'm trying to figure out how to convert to MP3. And I went around and I listened. First speaker tape I ever got was Greg Pierce. And the second speaker tape I got was a lady by the name of Blaze. And I wore Blaze out. Boy, I wore Blaze out and had to go get about 3 or 4 more Blazes, you know. And I listened to Mona. I listened to Doreen. I listened to Carmelita. Listen to Tina T, Dot Tally. Listen to Bobby and Sidney Raymar. And, listen to Vito, you know. Listen to, God, the list goes on and on and on and on. Because, and my greatest moments were getting to meet these people. I remember when I met Greg Pierce, I walked up to him like the, you know, we are not worthy little, and said, you don't know me, but you've ridden in my pickup truck with me for 1,000 miles. You know, and when people come up and do that to me now, like, I don't feel worthy to stand in their place, because I have a great deal of reverence for our predecessors, you know. And when they were doing what they were doing, they weren't doing it because one day they say, well, if we keep doing this, one day people will call us predecessors. You know, they were doing it to save their own ass, because they knew that what they were doing was, if it was important to them, it was going to be important to the people that followed behind them. And what we're doing here this morning, right here, is going to make a difference in the lives of addicts who haven't even been born yet. So we got to make sure that we do it careful. We got to protect it. You know, we got to stick to our traditions. We got to stick to our steps. We got to stick to the unconditional love. There's a sign. We share a meeting place. We share a meeting place with several fellowships in Lake Wells, and they put a sign up that said "No profanity." I have to laugh every time I saw that sign. I just went shit. Obviously, these people don't know addicts. I mean, do you know any addicts who have ever paid attention to a sign? You know, I mean, that's just an invitation to keep on doing what we're doing, you know. You want me to do something, tell me I can't do it, you see. But it said no profanity, and I got to thinking, I said, you know, the greatest profanity to me is to not extend the grace, love, and compassion to another addict that I've received myself. The greatest profanity to me is to look at another addict and say, you're too broken. You can't get this, you know. The greatest profanity to me is that which comes from our hearts and not our mouths. You know, because my first sponsor always used to say, out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth will speak. That means I have to take care of what's inside, you know. If I take care of my spirit, if I take care of my heart, then my mouth will take care of itself. You know, and I don't. One of the reasons I get asked to speak on Sunday morning a lot, because I'm country and I talk slow. And I don't cuss a lot, and it's not that I have anything against profanity, you know, because profanity, it really spices up a message, and sometimes that's the only thing you can say to make a point, you know. And I love it. I love them powerful speakers, you know. I wanted to be one of them, and somebody said, "No, Chuck, just be yourself," because there's somebody out in the audience that's going to have to hear Chuck, you know. But I would tell him, well, I'm not Vito, or I'm not Blaze, or I'm not Greg P, or I'm not Jimmy K, or I'm not this person, I'm not that. And my sponsor looked at me and said, and they're not you. You know? It takes every page to make a book. But, you know, I want to be page 217 where all the action happens. I don't want to be page 36, you know? But they always put me on Sunday morning because they confuse with, you know, because I talk slow and because I'm from the country and I don't yell a lot and I don't use a lot of profanity. They confuse that with spirituality. And it doesn't mean I'm spiritual. It just means I'm from the country. I talk slow and I don't use a lot of profanity. You know? And the reason I don't is because I've worked in the Postal Service for 40 years. And 10 of those years I was a supervisor. And I had to talk on the phone with the general public. And I have a lot of female employees. So I had to, over the years, I had to learn to say things in a better way. You know, and just because I'm not saying it don't mean I'm not thinking it. I got Tourette's, you know. I can string together some real long trains in my head, especially when I'm in traffic. You, God, so my son, you know. But thank God over the years and a lot of apologies and making amends, you know, the best apology to me now is the one I don't have to make. I've learned how to say things in a different way. Everything that comes out of my mouth has usually been through 3 or 4 filters before it gets out. I always have something that I do on Sunday morning because it gets me going, and I've got to get going because I don't want to talk too long because the mind can only absorb what the seat can endure. I've learned that from addicts. You know, we got real short attention spans, and if I sit here and y'all are going to get bored, and I don't want that. Y'all don't want that. I always have this thing that I do on Sunday mornings. There was a beautiful song that was written by Chris Christopherson. Goes something like this. I woke up Sunday morning with no way to hold my head that didn't hurt. And the beer I had for breakfast wasn't bad, so I had one more for dessert. I fumbled through the closet till I came across my cleanest dirty shirt. And I washed my face, I combed my hair, and stumbled down the stairs to meet the day. I smoked my brain the night before on cigarettes and songs that I was picking. I lit the first one of the day and watched a small child curse a can that he was kicking. And somewhere in the distance was the Sunday smell of someone frying chicken. And it took me back to something that I lost somewhere sometime long ago. On the Sunday morning sidewalk, wishing, Lord, that I was stoned. Because there's nothing like a Sunday to make a body feel alone. And there's nothing short of dying, half as lonesome as the sound, on that dirty city sidewalk as Sunday morning coming down, you know. I can say that to earth people, normal people, and they go, wow, that sounds depressing. But I can say that to a room full of addicts, and y'all are going, yeah. You know, y'all are circling dates on calendars. You know, remembering places you woke up in, strangers you woke up with, you know. Hey, how you doing? I'm Chuck. Who are you? You know, chew your arm off to get away without waking them up, you know. There's nothing worse than the feeling of waking up next to that person you said that there's just not enough drugs in the world for me to ever sleep with them, and waking up next to them and you think that's your bottom. You think that's your bottom until you become that person for somebody else. Because every time I think I hit a bottom, my disease just hands me a shovel and says, keep digging, pal. Keep digging. You're not through yet. I really want to thank the committee. I don't want to get away from here without thanking the committee. You guys have done an amazing job. This is... This is one of the finest, most spiritual conventions I have ever been to in my life, and I've been to a lot of them in 36 years. Because a lot of times I spend, because I have Tourette's, and I got about a half a dozen mental health professionals in Narcotics Anonymous in Polk County who swear to God I've got Asperger's. Me and Sheldon Cooper are a lot alike. If y'all ever watched The Big Bang Theory, but I get sensory overload. So when I get at a convention like this with a lot of people, I get a lot of stimulation, and sometimes I get overstimulated and I have to spend a lot of time in my room deprogramming or, processing that and getting rid of it. But this convention, I've been in a workshop since I got here. One workshop after another workshop after another workshop after another workshop, to the point where I went out and bought the whole convention package because I wanted to hear the ones I wasn't in. Because if they were as good as the ones I was in, man, what a convention you guys have had. I'm going to go back to Florida and I'm going to tell them, you guys, your convention experience is not complete until you go to MACNA out in Yuma, Arizona. Because I want to thank you. You've done a tremendous job, and I'm really humbled. I want to say this from the bottom of my addict heart. I'm really humbled to be in the presence of as much recovery as was in the room last night. There were about 15 people here with over 30 years clean. We don't have that many people with that much clean time at Frickna in Florida region, and there's like 3,500 people at Frickna. But there was about 15 people here with 30 years and up. There's two people with 40, And I'm sitting there going, that's about 500 years clean, about 15 people. So I'm humbled, I am humbled to be in the presence of those people. Because a lot of those people, I got their CDs sitting in my house. They ride around with me in my truck, So I'm almost afraid. I get up here and I tell my story. If I get it wrong, they may revoke my clean time. I may have to go back to being a newcomer, But I'm humbled. I'm humbled to be in the presence of that much recovery. And I thank the committee, and I'm humbled that you guys had enough trust in me to make me a part of your program, because that's not lost on me, and it frightens me. But like I say, this is a process of surrender, and I surrender to the power of my God and to the power of your unconditional love. I want to welcome the newcomer. My sponsor and I have this mantra. It's like whenever we speak, we always remind each other, thank the committee, welcome the newcomer, get the hell out of the way, So I'd like to welcome the newcomer. Anybody with a year or less, welcome. Welcome. You're the most important person. You're the most important person in this room, because we can't keep what we got if we don't have anybody to give it to. And you're the future of Narcotics Anonymous, because one day this old fart's going to be gone, and there's going to be, somebody else that's going to have to carry this message. I'm not going to tell you to keep coming back, not only the newcomers, but the old-timer. I'm not going to tell you to keep coming back. I'm just going to tell you to stay, just stay. Stay. Because if you've sat in this room, if you've felt the love, if you've seen the miracle, if you've pressed hearts with other addicts and you felt the power. I mean, when I'm in a room full of addicts, I can close my eyes and feel the energy in that room. It's almost like you can cut it with a knife. If you felt that and you go back out, you're going to find out that we forever put a cut on your high. Remember that movie, The Sixth Sense,
yes,
about the little boy? I see dead people. You know, if you go back out, you're going to see NA people for the rest of your life. You know? Keep coming back. Works if you work it. If you don't pick up, you won't get high. Mama, make them stop. I don't want to waste a lot of time telling my war story, because my war story is very basic. I lost the war, you know. I lost the war, you lost the war, and in losing the war, we found something much greater, and that's the freedom from active addiction. We had to be there in order to get here. So sometimes what I think is my greatest pain turned out to be my greatest blessing, because God was preparing me for what I have to do today, you know. There's this saying, you know, I've read somewhere, I will return to you the day of the locust, you know. And this is what, you know, this is what we're experiencing here. I don't have to tell you my war story. All basically, you know, because I laugh every time I'm in a meeting and a newcomer stands up and spends 20 minutes telling the room why they're there. It's like, baby, we know why you're here. we know why you're here. Just sit down, listen. We love you. Keep coming back. You know? Because I did it myself. You know, I know why they do it, because I did the same thing. You know. All I have to do is tell you I'm an addict, and I tell you a lot of things about me that you already know. You know, when I tell you I'm an addict.
Oh.
And I came up here with the literature. This is kind of like my whoopee. You know, I've got to have it close to me. When I tell you I'm an addict, I tell you that I'm an egomaniac with low self-esteem.
Right.
When I tell you I'm an addict, I tell you that I judge my worth by who I'm with or who I know rather than by who I am. You know, when I tell you I'm an addict, I tell you that my drug of choice is more. You know, there's no such thing as enough. You know, three things you'll never hear an addict say is, what's in this, you go first, and no thanks, I've had enough. When I tell you I'm an addict, I tell you I don't understand any part of the word no or wait. See? When I tell you I'm an addict, I tell you the words I'm sorry are a setup. You see, your trust is my greatest weapon. My idea of friendship is to steal all your shit and then help you look for it. You see. When I tell you I'm an addict, I tell you I don't have boundaries. I got booby traps. You see, emotional snares, psychological tripwires, minefields full of guilt and shame. See, when I tell you I'm an addict, I tell you I'm a master of the complicated, overwhelmed by the simple. See, my solution to a problem is usually worse than the problem. When I tell you I'm an addict, I tell you that I don't have to be with another person to be in a bad relationship. When I tell you I'm an addict, I tell you that I have a disease that talks to me in my own voice. That I've watched all my yets become my agains. When I tell you I'm an addict, I tell you that I have diplomatic immunity from the laws that govern the universe and the rest of mankind. You know, the words express lane, 10 items or less, handicap parking, take only as directed. You know, do not mix with alcohol or operate heavy machinery. Don't you know who I think I am? You know? It's always about me. Even when it's about you, it's about me. When I tell you I'm an addict, I tell you, I take pride in my humility. Hey, and I'm just talking about me. You know the scary part about it? Is you're laughing because you identify. There's going to be that moment when you look up there and go, that guy's crazy. And then the next moment's going to be, damn, I know exactly what he's talking about. And that's when you're going to know that you're in the place where you belong. You see. When I tell you I'm an addict, I tell you that pain is my greatest teacher. You know, I got to touch the stove to see if it's hot. I got to touch the paint to see if it's wet. I got to open the door to see why it's closed. And because I'm from Bubba Country, Polk County, I got to pee on the barbed wire fence to see if it's really electric. Like the sign says. You see. How? Look at me, I'm a Christmas tree, you know. I'm a victim. I'm a victim by choice. I'm a victim by choice. I hide in plain sight. I'm alone in a crowd. I say what I don't mean and mean what I don't say. You see, I'll show you by killing me. You see. When I tell you I'm an addict, I tell you I've been in some dope holes where angels wouldn't go. But the scariest neighborhood I ever walked through in my life is the one between my ears. You see. When I tell you I'm an addict, I tell you I've watched all my yets become my agains. That broken is a beginning. When I tell you I'm an addict, I tell you that I confuse the price with the prize, that powerlessness equals permission. When I tell you I'm an addict, I tell you that I'm not finished with anything until I'm done, you know. And I found out in Narcotics Anonymous that had enough is like right here, and done is somewhere over here. And the place between had enough and done is a place called hell. And I don't have to explain that to you. Because you've been there with me. That's the great thing about being in Narcotics Anonymous. I don't have to explain nothing to you. All I have to do is say I'm an addict. You know my story. I know your story. Addicts don't hear what other addicts say. Addicts feel what other addicts say. You see. When I tell you I'm an addict, I tell you that I've got a secret. It says in our literature that addicts tend to live secret lives. I've got a secret. You know, that secret, I'm not talking about the little shit we tell each other, you know, in meetings or, you know, in our step. I'm talking about that secret, the one that made you think that using was the solution, that made you think that death was more attractive than life. You see, because when I tell you I'm an addict, I tell you that I will run from life and embrace death, the death of addiction. That secret that brought you into these rooms, that you don't even want to tell anybody, not even your sponsor, and you read in the step working guide. Now, after you finish this step, is there anything that you haven't said that you want to say? And you know that addicts wrote that book. It's like, oh, yeah, that secret. And then you come into a meeting and you hear somebody else tell your secret and call it their own. And you know you found a home. And depending on the gender of the person speaking, probably his sponsor, you know. Because I know I chose my sponsor when he was in a meeting. He said he had a disturbed spirit. And I went, uh-huh, you're mine. You're mine because I'll see your disturbed spirit and raise you the five voices I got in my head. I'll tell you a little bit about myself. I don't want to go into a lot of it. I was the child of a broken home. My mother and father divorced. I was put up for adoption. I spent my whole life thinking that, you know, I was less than, I was broken. There was something wrong with me or my mom and dad wouldn't have left. And my father was a pilot for Eastern Airlines, and my mother had a couple of master's degrees in education for exceptional children. So it wasn't like they couldn't raise a child, you know. I found out that I was adopted when I was 15. And I was never able to process that. That damaged me for the rest of my life. You know, I mean, it got up here in my Tourette's brain, and it wouldn't go because, you know, I don't know if you've ever had Tourette's. And I started talking about it because I figured, you know, in a crowd this large, there's probably somebody else out there that suffered from this, because I spent my life thinking I was demon-possessed and down to hell. Because my skin always felt like it was three sizes too small. My head always felt like it was too small for my brain. My motor's always running. You know, I had the verbal tics. I had the barking. You know, sometimes I've just got to make noise, you know, to, ow! You know, just kind of, ow! You know, and I do that, you know, it's just got to come out. And I sing, I hum, I'll get a song stuck in my head. That's what I was going through last night when Tony came over and asked me if I was all right. I said, yeah, it's just that I'm overtired and I'm overstimulated and my Tourette's is coming out in me. I'm sitting over there waiting to get up on the stage and I'm rocking, bouncing back and forth off the chair. And, you know, I've come to the point in my life where I've accepted that that's what I've got. I might as well damn entertain myself with it. You see? There's nothing I can do about it. I might as well just have some fun with it, you know. Because one of the things that Narcotics Anonymous has taught me is to turn our flaws into our advantage, is to take the things that we think make us less than into things that make us servants, the things that help us to help other people. It's kind of funny. I'll get something stuck in my head. You know, like when I'm out delivering mail, I realize I've been humming the same song for 2 hours. You know, the worst day I ever had in my life, I got Wayne Newton's Dunk of Shame. Dunk of Shame, darling, Dunk of Shame. You know. Stuck in her head now. You see, this is contagious. I called my girlfriend up and said, baby, come shoot me, because I got Wayne Newton stuck in my head. So she said, you know, just change the channels, you know. So I went to Deep Purple, you know, dun, 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 dun. But when you're a child and you've got that, you know, the worst thing you can be as a child is different. You know, the worst thing you can be is different, and people made fun of. I felt isolated. I felt alone. I had a hard time in social interactions. I wanted to be friends, but I didn't know how. I sought solace in religion. I wanted to be a preacher because I thought the greatest thing in the world would be to make a difference in people, to take away their pain. Would be to take away their pain because I was in pain. I knew what it was like to be in pain, so I felt a great empathy towards people in pain. And you know the difference between empathy and sympathy, don't you? Sympathetic person hears the story of the addict and they go, wow, that's so sad. The empathetic person hears the story of the addict and goes, I've been right there and I know how to get out. You know. But I wanted to take away people's pain. But my mom, I tell people I'm a recovering Pentecostal. Because my mom got about 12 preachers on her side of the family, and I wasn't going to be one of them. You know, I wasn't going to be number 13. So being the people pleaser that I am, because I will abandon myself for other people's approval. I mean, there's nobody in the world who has sold me out the way that I have. There's nobody who's ever rejected me the way that I have. There's nobody who's ever betrayed me the way that I have. There's nobody who's ever lied to me the way that I have. There's nobody who's ever abused me the way that I have, you know. My greatest task when I came into recovery was not getting other people, was not being the kind of person that you will like. It's being the kind of person that I will like. See, because I spent my whole life living with my greatest enemy. And that's somebody that wanted to kill me every day because they couldn't stand to be me. It was like being chained to your worst enemy every day, 24 hours a day. That voice in my head that says, you're a piece of shit. You know? They don't like you. They hate me. They hate you. You're broken. You can't do this. I came into Narcotics Anonymous. I learned that I had to empty my mind of the word can't. You see. If you're sitting out there and you're telling yourself you can't go back to school, you can't get in a relationship, you can't work the steps, you can't work out because you're 61 years old with a pacemaker and COPD. I mean, I weighed 330 pounds a couple of years ago. I weigh 250 now because I went back to a gym. But for years, I told myself, I can't. And then one day, all of the reasons that you tell yourself you can't become all of the reasons that you try. And that's when you know you're done. I'm done. It's over. That's what brought me into Narcotics Anonymous. I was done. I was one of those people that was blessed to be done. I wanted to be a preacher. I abandoned myself. Went to a large school. Went to Florida State University in Tallahassee, Florida. This was 1970, Woodstock generation. And all the kids from Lake Wales who were at Tallahassee decided, wouldn't it be fun if we got Chuck high? Because I was so straight. I was such a straight-laced little kid. Wouldn't it be fun if we got him high? Like, let's hold the cat upside down, blow smoke in his face, blow marijuana in his face and drop it and see if it lands on its feet, you know? And they did, you know. Very first time I ever got high, and I know we don't mention specific drugs, but I took some mescaline and went to see the Allman Brothers Band and Frank Zappa, the Mothers of Invention, you know. And Frank Zappa stood up on stage and said, we are the people our parents warned us about. And it was an omen because a couple of weeks later, the people that got me high came up to me and said, you know, Chuck, you're not supposed to do this every day. I mean, it was on. It was on because the first time I got high was such a release from that Tourette's, you know. It was like, oh, man, it was on. It was on for the next 7 years. It was on. Because if you didn't use like I used, get the hell out of the way. Because we're fixing to go for a ride, you know. A year after they turned me on, all the people that thought it was funny to get me high were buying all their stuff from me. Because I went from being the straight-laced kid that wanted to be a preacher into being the dealer, you know. And it wasn't long. A year after I started getting high, I was in the blackouts. I quit going to class. Back in those days, if you were under 21, you weren't legal, so my parents told me I had to come home. When I came home, I got a job in a lumber company, which, you know, the construction business is not a good place to be if you, you know, don't want to use. Ended up getting a job in the Postal Service. It was kind of crazy because I told people to leave school because I didn't want to spend the rest of my life working with crazy people because I was majoring in psychology. I didn't want to spend the rest of my life working with crazy people and got a job in the Postal Service. You know? I got a job in the Postal Service. I was always in trouble in the Postal Service. I was always this far away from getting fired. But because it was a union job, you know, they had to go through the rules of firing you. And I always managed to squeak by, you know. I was always losing my car. I had a car. I'd wake up in the morning, I'd look out the window, the car would be gone. And, you know, you have to make those phone calls. Hey, man, did you see me last night? Where was I? Is my car there? Okay, great. Normal people get high and lose their car, they quit getting high. You see, addicts get high and lose their car, they quit driving. Which is exactly what happened to me because I walked out one day and I had a dead battery. My car wouldn't start, and I only lived about four blocks from work. So I said, well, I'll just walk to work and I'll fix my car when I get home. And I got home, and all I wanted to do was get high, and I didn't want to wait 2 hours for my neighbor with the jumper cables. So I told myself, well, I'll get high today. I can walk to work again tomorrow. My car sat in the garage for 2 years. My car sat in the garage for 2 years with a dead battery. And people would say, man, when are you going to fix your car? And I said, when are you going to mind your own business, man? You know, when you stand up for non-existent values, you know. When are you going to mind your own business, you know. Of course, you don't have a car, you know, you don't have a social life. You know, our world shrank and isolation became a way of life. It says that in the basic text. I became suicidal, you know. I got on the merry-go-round of the mental health. You know, I was in and out of the Mary Strang unit. I was in and out of 7 East. I was in and out of Palmview. I was in and out of Peace River. You know, because I grew up with all the policemen in Lake Wales, and they wouldn't arrest me. They just take me to, you know, they'd Baker Act me, because back then they could Baker Act you. Now it's a little bit more difficult. And I remember there were a couple of suicide attempts, and I remember the last suicide attempt. I remember waking up in the intensive care of the Lake Wales Hospital with my mother sitting at my bed, and the doctor came in and he started explaining things to me. They said, you know, because it was a drug overdose, because they had given me medication, you know, because I was in outpatient services, and they had given me enough medication to kill this table right over here. You know? And I used it. And he came in and said, you know, when we brought you in here, you were unresponsive, which was a polite term, you know, for dead. You were unresponsive. You had no vitals. We thought we were going to lose you. We were fixing to call you, you know, time of death. And all of a sudden, I just sat up. You know, I just sat up, and I started pulling the hose out of my throat, and I started pulling the IVs out of my arms, and just scared the hell out of the deputy, you know, because a corpse sat up and started talking to him. Hey, man, what's going on? You know? How's the wife and kids? You know? And they said, my God, he's alive. And they put me back down, and they put me in intensive care. And I woke up. This happened on a Sunday, and I woke up on a Thursday. And my mother's sitting at the foot of the bed, and she's writing on a yellow legal pad because my mom believes in automatic writing. And what she was writing on the yellow legal pad, with no knowledge of 12-step recovery meetings whatsoever, was, I am so much, you are so much, but together we are so much more, you see. The doctor came in and said, you know, I don't know how you're living your life, but you need to make some changes, because the next time this happens, we're not going to be able to save you. We're not going to be able to save you, because there was no reason for me to be alive, because by the time I got to the emergency room, there was nothing for me to pump out of my stomach. You know, it had all gone into my system. I should have died. He said, the only reason you're alive is because God sovereignly decided it was not your time to go. And armed with that information, after I got out of the Mary Strang unit again, because, you know, they didn't let me just take my clothes and walk away. After I got out of the Mary Strang unit 2 weeks later, I went out and used for another 18 months. You know, I know what it's like to use against my will. You know, Brenda was talking about using against your will. And they say insanity is doing the same thing, expecting different results. I was doing the same thing, knowing exactly what was going to happen, and that's a place called hopelessness. You know, and I don't have to explain that to you, because you've all lived in that neighborhood. You've all stood on the corner of hopelessness and despair. You know. Until I wound up on that bathroom floor, you know, because I was looking out, like I said this morning, onto that beautiful painted desert, and I was remembering that bathroom floor. I wound up on that bathroom floor telling God, you got to either help me or kill me, because I can't live like this anymore. I called the Postal Service and said, I need help. Man, that's a miracle right there. Anytime an addict reaches out and says, I need help, because, you know, I'd rather make a mess and prove that I've got a problem than admit that I got a problem for asking for help, you know. And they said, stay right there. You're on sick leave as of right now. We'll call you. About an hour later, they called me back and said, we want you to come up here tomorrow at 9 o'clock. There's a guy coming over from St. Petersburg. He's going to talk to you. I went in the office the next day, and the postmaster gave us his office, which was, you know, really important. I mean, the postmaster walked out and locked the door and said, this is right here. Y'all just stay in here until you're done. And the guy looked at me and said, my name's Bill. I want to tell you a little bit about myself. You know, he didn't look at me and say, you're an addict, you're a junkie, you're a loser. You're breaking your mom and daddy's heart. You're letting your bosses down. Can't you get your shit together? No, he said, my name's Bill. I want to tell you about myself. You know. And he talked about himself. After 45 minutes, he looked at me and said, now that I've told you about myself, is there anything you can identify with? And I felt as though the weight of the entire world had been lifted off my shoulders, because I thought I was demon-possessed and damned to hell, and found out that all I was an addict, you know, which was a great relief to me, because I can do addict time, you know. I can't do demon-possessed and damned to hell time, but I can do addict time. You see, because all I had to do was go to these meetings. Shit. Sign me up, man. I'll be the best addict you ever saw. But the Postal Service, you know, because I entered into their program, I had to play by their rules, which meant treatment. I had to go into treatment. Y'all know about treatments where you spend thousands of dollars to find out that meetings are free, right? But I had to go into treatment. I got into treatment the very first night I was in treatment. I'm reading the steps, you know. I got down to the third step, you know. And the word God was there. And I went, oh, my God, I don't know if I can do this, because I believe that God had damned me to hell because I wanted to be a preacher and became an addict instead, because I had a God of my misunderstanding. Worse, I had a God of somebody else's misunderstanding. But years ago, I had surgery on my eyes because I had two detached retinas. I almost lost my vision. And I was talking to the surgeon, and he was talking to me about this new procedure that they were doing. And I said, well, what is the success rate? And he said, about 90%. And I said, only 90%? And he looks at me and goes, well, let's put it this way, Chuck. You got 100% chance of going blind if we don't do this. Because, you know, being like a good addict, I took the odds, you know, because I figured I had a better chance with a God that might send me to hell than with a disease that had already taken me there and dropped me off. And I got down on my knees and I said, God, I know you exist because a lot of people spend a lot of time talking about you, but I don't know you. Kind of like I know Abraham Lincoln existed, but I never met him, you know. I don't have any personal knowledge, you know. I just got a lot of historical information. And I'm not even going to make you any promises because I know I won't keep them. Man, you get an addict to admit that. I'm not even going to make any promises because I know I won't keep them, but if you don't help me, I'm going to die. And that was November the 1st, 1977. And from that moment till now, I've never had to use it again. And I can't take credit for that. I remember going to sleep. I remember going to sleep and waking up about 3 o'clock in the morning, and I felt like I wasn't alone in that room. I felt like there was a presence. It was like there was a voice in me that was speaking so loud. He might have been standing over in a corner. And what he was saying, and I had this sense of peace that just flooded through me that I had never felt. You know, it's going to be okay. You know, you don't ever have to be that sick again. But you have to spend the rest of your life helping people just like you. And I used to tell that story all the time until I found out that Jimmy Kennan had a similar experience, and I quit telling it because I didn't want people to think I was putting myself up there with Jimmy, you know. And an old-timer came up to me and said, you know, Chuck, if that's the way it happened, you need to tell it that way, because there might be somebody else in the room who's had a similar experience whose disease is trying to tell them that it didn't really happen. Because a lot of people will say, oh, well, you were just going through withdrawal. You know, I sure as hell didn't run up and tell the nurse that God was in my room, because, you know, Thorazine can be a spiritual experience too. You just think you saw God. Bend over. But I remember going to the first meeting in Seven West. They had H&I meetings that came in. There was a guy named John Davis. He used to come and pick us up in a van every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday night. And every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday night, I was in the van with John Davis. And I can say his name because he's passed away now. But John Davis was one of my H&I angels. Those of you who do H&I, God bless you. You know, I'm here because of H&I. Those of you who don't, think about it. Talk to your sponsor, because I tell you, the one person who will be blessed is you. You see, the one person who will be blessed. I always leave H&I feeling guilty because I feel like I got more out of it than the people in it. You know, very first meeting I was at, this guy walked in and I delivered his mail, and he was the editor of the hometown newspaper, and I'm like, oh shit. You know, I start sliding under the table because I can just see the headline. You know, mailman in treatment. because it was all about me, you know. And then it suddenly dawned on me, what is this guy doing here? Because the only people in the room were there for a meeting. And I sat up and I started looking at him, and he started talking. He said, man, he's one of us, you know. And I had never seen him high. I'd never read his name in the paper. I mean, he was respected in our community. And he came over after the meeting, and he says, you know my name because you deliver my mail. But here's my phone number. If there's anything I can do for you, give me a call. And he was my first sponsor. John became my first sponsor. He got up, and this was in November. He got up and got in his car and drove 80 miles round trip just to talk to a stranger because he heard the mailman was in treatment. Because that's what they did back. You know, I grew up in an era, in the era when the old timers didn't have enough time to be politically correct because they were too busy trying to save your ass. I remember this one old-timer, Don Golden. He used to say these things. We called him the Golden Rule. Don Golden was a Native American who grew up on an Indian reservation and worked in the oil fields in Houston. So you know his social graces, you know, were kind of rough. I mean, he used to tell people, my name is Don. I grew up on the Indian reservation. That's about it for my social using, you know. But he used to say stuff like, you know, Chuck, if your world seems like a dark place, you might try pulling your head out your ass. You know? Tony's smiling because he's probably said that to a few people too. And Jack, you might try pulling your head out your ass, you know. And Don would get the thing that would make him the maddest is when people would say that there was no recovery in Narcotics Anonymous. You know? Boy, that would light his fuse, you know. And Don had a way of saying things that I can't repeat in a meeting. You know, I've kind of had to water them down a little bit so I can say them in mixed crowds and, you know, crowds where there's people, you know, children maybe. But the way he said them, I will never forget them, you know. Because people would, you know, back in the early days when NA first started, because I was in AA for 8 years before NA even came to Central Florida. I mean, Central Florida is the black hole of everything. You know, everything comes to Polk County last, except drugs, of course. Everything comes to us last. So the first NA meeting I ever went to was in 1986. Well, by that time, I had 8.5 years clean. And Don Golden, that's okay, man. It was the way it had to be for us to be here. Don Golden would get really mad because there was kind of a saying going around, and people didn't think about it when they said it. They said it because they heard somebody else say it, not because they had any personal experience. They were just repeating, lip-syncing, parroting. Oh, there's no recovery in that fellowship. Oh, there's no recovery in that meeting. And Don Golden would look at him and go, well, if there wasn't any recovery in that meeting, it's because you didn't bring none with you. One guy was talking about there wasn't any recovery in that, and this guy had been stalking this girl from meeting to meeting to meeting, and she went off with someone else, you know, and he got really pissed off and said, there was no recovery in that meeting. And Don said, don't tell me there's no recovery in a meeting that you went to looking to get laid, you know. That was the way Don was. That was the way those old-timers were. And God loved them, because my sponsor was one of them. My first sponsor was one of them. And he used to tell me to never get separated from the herd, because he was an old cowboy. He was an old cowboy. He herded cattle when he was a boy. And he said, you know, before you can brand a steer, you got to rope a steer. Before you can rope a steer, you got to cut it from the herd. You know, don't get cut from the herd. And there's a lot of ways that people get cut from the herd. You know, sometimes the disease doesn't cut us from the herd. Sometimes we just get bored and walk the hell off. You know. I was at a convention one time, and the theme of the convention was no matter what, no matter what. We think that no matter what is death, disease, divorce, all the bad stuff that happens, you know, loss of a job, loss of a relationship, loss of a child, no matter what. Oh, if your ass falls off, put it in a bag, bring it to a meeting. But I've seen just as many people go out of these rooms because of the blessings that they got in Narcotics Anonymous. You get the house, you get the relationship, you get the job, you get the car, you get the family, you go back to school. Life gets full, and the first thing we start cutting out is the very thing that made all of that possible. Get the 50-inch plasma TV. Want to sit at home and watch Cops, you know. Because if you're like me, I don't watch TV. I get involved in it. I become one of, you know, watching Cops. Oh, man, don't hide the drugs there. Loser. You know. You're going to jail, you know. Celebrity rehab is another one that used to just bake me, you know. Alcohol is a drug, Dr. Drew, you know. Please, you know. And Dog the Bounty Hunter, you know. I see these people in these brand new SUVs. There'd be about five or six brand new SUVs with all this technology and, you know, these big cans of mace about this big. And they'd be chasing this one little toothless guy on a bicycle. On an island. I rooted for the toothless guy. Come on, man. You can do this. Come on. But anyway, I spent 8 years in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I came into Narcotics Anonymous, the very first meeting we ever had in Lake Wales. I was there. And in 1987, we had 8 meetings in a 3-county area. We had 8 meetings. And I used to have to go to other meetings, you know, because if I wanted to go to a meeting every night, you know, there was only 8 meetings. And they were all on the weekend, because we didn't have, you know, like Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday meetings like addicts didn't use on Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, right? So I'd go to other meetings, and Don Golden racked me up about that one night. He says, "How come you go to those other meetings over there?" And I said, "Well, because there's no clean time in this fellowship." And he says, "Well, why don't you stick around? The next guy who comes in won't be able to say that." I say, "Because, you know, addicts, we can't enjoy the good because we're always looking for the better. The only trouble is when we find the better, we don't stop looking." You see, we don't stop looking. And Don Golden and my sponsor John and my sponsor Ron, who's my sponsor today, have told me you need to bloom where you planted, because God put you there for a reason. Right. Don't spend a lot of time running around looking for a better meeting if you haven't done everything in your power to make your home group the best home group that it is. Don't look for a better relationship if you haven't invested yourself in the one that you've got. A better job, a better life. You see, better is in here. Better is not out here. You see. Right here. The only trouble is we don't have any faith in ourselves. I spent my whole life rejecting myself, and I didn't even know who I was. You know, you want to confuse the hell out of an addict, just say, "Hey, man, be yourself." It's like put somebody in a round room telling them to sit in the corner, you know. I don't know who that is. I had to work a 4-step to find out who I was. You know, a 4-step, the purpose of a searching and fearless moral inventory is to sort through the confusion and contradiction of our lives. Man, when I came in these rooms, I was confused and contradicted, you know, because I was a different person from situation to situation and from group to group, you know. I don't want to talk long. You know, it's really hard to talk about 7 years of using and 36 years of recovery in 45 minutes. Because, you know, I could stand up here and talk forever. If you don't identify with me today, keep coming back. You'll find somebody who will come in here and tell your story. It's okay if you don't identify with me. If everybody in this room identified with me, Narcotics Anonymous would be in trouble. You see? because we'd all be the same person. And we wouldn't attract anybody any different than us. You know, one of our greatest strengths is our diversity. Today we've got like 65 meetings of Narcotics Anonymous in the Heartland area. And we're very rural. You know, we've got a lot of land, square miles. You know, it's very country. We're very rural. That's what we call it. That's what other people call it. We have a lot of other things that we say besides rural. Living in Polk County is like Duck Dynasty on meth. If you can picture that. Happy, happy, happy. I got something I want to read because I'm getting short. Come on. I got the Senior Citizens Edition. Does anybody think I need a new book up here? You know, I mean, this has got spiral. You know, it's a museum piece. It's got a spiral back because, you know, that was the first one, and they quit making them. Like I said, you know, the greatest profanity is not that which I say. It's looking at another addict and saying, we can't help you. And it says in step 12 of It Works How and Why, it's absolutely none of our business to decide who is ready to hear the message of recovery and who is not. Many of us have formed such a judgment about an addict's desire for recovery and have been mistaken. Multiple relapses do not necessarily signify a lack of interest in recovery, nor does the model newcomer demonstrate without a doubt a certainty of making it. It is our purpose and our privilege to share the message of recovery unconditionally with anyone expressing a desire to receive it. There was this guy named Frank. I'll tell you about Frank, and I'll get the hell out of here. And those of you who've heard about Frank, you know, please just be patient. Frank was audio hallucinatory schizophrenic. And those of you who know, you ever saw the movie A Beautiful Mind with Russell Crowe? Audio hallucinatory schizophrenic means Frank had invisible friends. And he brought them to meetings with him. You know, I mean, when you walked into a meeting where Frank was, you know, you walked up to a chair and go, is this seat taken? But my sponsor said, you're going to help this guy. You're going to help this guy. You're going to take him to meetings. You're going to work with him. Because Frank was really scary. Frank was my size. You know, and he dressed in biker, you know, leather and black shirt and dark glasses, chains and knuckle buster rings and the bandana, and drove a Pinto. And he could say two things, yeah and wow. Yeah, wow. And Frank scared the hell out of me because he was my size. And, you know, you looked in his eye, he had the scariest eyes I've ever seen. Because, you know, the light was on, but he definitely wasn't home. And I carried a gun in my truck down in the little pocket. I carried a little 380 because I just knew Frank was going to cut my heart out and, you know, leave me alongside the road. And I can remember talking to my sponsor, you want me to take him to a meeting alone? But back then you did what your sponsor told you to do, you know, because that man had the authority to revoke my clean time. It's like, get in the truck, John, you know. Okay, shut up and get in the truck. Okay, I took him to meetings. I took him to meetings for about 6 weeks. Took him to meeting about 6 weeks, and he'd be transfixed. He'd go into the men's room. He'd be transfixed by his reflection in the mirror. And you have to go in there, Frank, time to go. Yeah, wow, you know. I was so glad they didn't have those automatic motion detector, you know, time. We'd still be in the bathroom. But I did that for about 6 weeks, and Frank went back to Chicago. He went back to Chicago, and I was so happy. I was never so glad to see anybody go, you know, bye, Frank, don't write. And I thought I was like Mr. Recovery because I had survived Frank, you know. And I forgot about him. About 2 or 3 years went by, and I walked into a meeting one night, and I heard this voice, hi, Chuck. Ha-ha. My turn, and it's it's Frank, but I can't remember his name, you know. And I go, well, hi, do you remember me? It's Frank. Frank, how you doing, Frank? Well, I'm doing okay. I'm working the steps. I'm reading the basic text. I had a little relapse, but I'm back in the rooms. I'm down here visiting my uncle. I got 2 years clean, and I'm chairing the meeting tonight. Of course, all I could say was, yeah, wow. Wow. And God used Frank to teach me a lesson, because, you know, if we're not humble, we will be humiliated. I was setting up a meeting. Frank moved to Lake Wales. He became our coffee maker. And the coffee was measured to the last grain. The circle was geometrically perfect. You know, and if you want to get in trouble, just dink one of the chairs. Oh, no. You know. And I'm sitting there talking to Frank one night. He and I are sitting up the room. I'm full of myself, you know, because I know none of y'all have ever taken credit for another person's recovery. But well, Frank, every time I see you, I'm just reminded that God is in the miracle business. I'm just so proud that I got to be a part of your recovery and la-da-da-da-yada-yada. And what I'm saying in my head is, aren't you glad I was in your life because nobody else wanted to have anything to do with you? You'd still be in that damn bathroom. But I'm sitting there taking credit, and Frank doesn't kid. He doesn't have the capacity to kid. Now, he'll laugh at stuff, you know, during the moment of silence. That's okay. We just kind of, yeah. But he doesn't have the ability to kid or to laugh or to generate humor. And I'm sitting there telling him what a miracle he is and taking credit for all his recovery. And he just looked at me and went, well, Chuck, I just kept telling myself, if you could do it, I could do it too. Ding. Dunkashane, darling, Dunkashane. Come to find out, the longer I knew Frank, the more step work I did on myself. There was a reason why my sponsor put me with him. And that's the message in Narcotics Anonymous. If Frank's still clean. You know, he doesn't dress like a biker anymore. He cut off the beard and got some glasses and dresses like a Presbyterian minister now. He's still got that voice. Hi, Chuck. Hi, Frank. Yeah, wow. But if schizophrenic Frank and Tourette's boy Chuck can get clean and stay clean, you know, come on. You know, if we can do this, you can do this. You know, it's really simple. It's a simple program for complicated people, you know. I mentioned before that I was, tell you one more thing that I get. I mentioned before that I was an adopted child. I knew who my mother was because she was my aunt. How much more time do I have? 10 minutes? Oh, great, I got it. You should be scared anytime an addict says, I got it. That should terrify you. But I always wondered about my dad. I always wondered if my dad thought about me. You know, did he think about me? Did he, you know, because I never heard from him. I never had anything to do with him, you know. And I always just kind of wondered, you know, because that messed with my head. It messed with my head. I'm an addict. I had Tourette's. It messed with my head. It would never leave. It was just always down there. And I always wanted to, like, you know, when I got clean, I always wanted to, like, get in touch with my dad just to tell him that I was okay and I'd had a good life and, you know, just in case he wondered. I didn't have any resentments, you know. But I just, curiosity, you know, curiosity is fatal to addicts. I mean, curiosity is an obsession, you know. And I just always had these questions that never, 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 never got answered about myself. Because I'm sitting there doing step work and trying to find out about myself, and there's a whole lot of information that wasn't even there, you know. And but every time I would bring the subject up, my mother would get really upset because it threatened the family circle. You know, it threatened the integrity of our family unit when I wanted to know about my dad, you know. So I finally learned to just shut up about it, to keep peace in the family. And I just kind of buried it inside me so deep that I didn't even remember it was there anymore. And about 2 years ago, I was getting ready to go do some service somewhere, and I got this letter in the mail. And it's not unusual, you know, if you ever shared at a convention, for somebody to look up your address and write you a letter and thank you for, you know, your message and tell you what it meant to them. And, you know, it's just something I've gotten used to. I'm always touched by it because, like I say, I don't feel like I'm worthy to be in the company of my predecessors. And everybody in this room is somebody's predecessor. Everybody in this room, you stay in here long enough. Everybody in this room, there's somebody out there that only you can reach. Chuck can't reach him. Jack can't reach him. Tony can't reach him. John and Brenda can't reach him. Only you can reach him. You know, we are the visible proof of an invisible power working in the lives of addicts today. Exhibit A. I got this letter, and I started reading it. It said, "Chuck, my name is Eva. I am writing to you because I have been looking for someone for many years, and I am hoping you could help me out. Please continue to read my letter to you before you make up your mind on responding to me. I am 51 years old, and when I was 12, I was told my father had been married prior to my mom and that he had had a son. I was not able to get more info about him because a few months later, my father died. My mother didn't know much, and what info she did have was not much help, you see. Recently, I uncovered some papers I never knew existed that shed some light, answered some questions, and has led me to you. I believe you are the person that I have been searching for. If you are, please know that I in no way want to interfere with your life or disrupt your life or family. I understand your parents' love for you, and I'm so happy you were able to have a better life than what you would have had in a single-parent home. I just want to know if you are the person I have searched for. I have some photos, documents, and such you might want, but I understand if you don't. Please know I will not push you in any way for a relationship. It is up to you. I would like to give you my email address. If you are the person, please just let me know, and we can go from there. If you have any questions, I would be happy to answer them. The person I am looking for was born October the 28th, 1952, at Crawford Long Memorial Hospital in Atlanta, Georgia. Father Robert Alden Orr, mother June Evelyn Freeman Orr, was named Thomas Stewart Orr, was adopted by Charles Roberta Harriman sometime around 1957, early 1958. Thank you for taking time to read my letter, Eva. You know, I had a half-sister who'd been looking for me for 30 years. Don't leave 15 minutes before the miracle. You see, because sometimes God answers prayers that are in our hearts so deep that we aren't even aware of them. You know, because only God knows the desires and longings of our heart. We think we know the desires and the longings of our heart. You know, I wanted to be a preacher. Well, it's Sunday morning. I'm talking to a pretty good crowd. God doesn't need any more preachers. God needed messengers. The only trouble to be able is that to be a messenger, you be part of the crowd that you can be. So everything that we've suffered was preparation for all of the good that we're about to do. You know, because we got to take what we got. You know, all those voices, you know, when you're on the airplane, it says, "Ladies and gentlemen, take your seat because we're about to land." Well, that's the Sunday morning speaker. We got to leave this place of this great spiritual high that we've had, that we've been on for 3 days, and go back into the world. I would love to live in convention mode, but that's not the reality of life outside the rooms. You know, we've got to take what we've been given out into our home groups and beyond, to our workplace, to life. You know, I'm a mailman, and I used to think that in order to be of service, I had to quit working in the post office and go off to the mission field somewhere. And all of a sudden, I realized I got 1,000 opportunities today to show kindness to someone else, to bloom where I'm planted, bloom where you're planted. You're there for a reason. Every time God puts somebody somewhere and they leave, he's got to put somebody else there. You see? I want to thank you for letting me be here. I always read this one thing. Where is it? It's by Elie Wiesel. I got a couple of things. Elie Wiesel was a Holocaust survivor, and there is no Holocaust that I've ever known that is greater than this people than any war, you know. And it says Elie Wiesel was a Holocaust survivor. Kingdom of the night. A moment of grace, every hour an offering. Not to share them would be to betray them. Our lives no longer belong to us alone. They belong to all those who need us desperately. You see. I always say a poem and then I get out of here. It's called The Outstretched Hand. And it's about the spirit of we. And it goes like this. Each of us was made by God and some of us grew tall. Others stood out in the wind. Their branches bent and fell. Those of us who walk in light must help the ones in darkness up. For that's what life is all about, and love is all there is to life. Each of us was made by God, beautiful in his mind's eye. Those of us who turned out sound should look across our shoulders once and help the weak ones to their feet. You don't stretch hand. Let's say, brothers and sisters, thank you for being the outstretched hand to me. I love you. God bless you.